Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Andy Boyd. Andy is the owner and founder of Pandion Games and the designer of games like Waffles for Esther, Badger and Coyote, Substratum Protocol, Whispers in the Walls, and most recently, Midnight Muscadines. Andy, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So good to have you.
So great to have you here.
We were joking off mic that you and I have been orbiting each other for probably three or 4 years now online. It's very nice to finally hear your voice and put a face to the
Absolutely.
Name.
I feel like that is pretty much everybody in the TTRPG community that has met on Twitter and now Blue Sky, where it's like, we know each other, we've never talked to each other. So yeah, it's very nice to finally put a face and a voice to the name.
It is interesting that it's fun for me being slightly on the outside of this, of seeing like Elliot's at More Blueberries have similar timelines with other people that we interview, and it's like, ooh, what are they doing? What how are these people doing stuff differently? And it's very cool.
I love that.
And we're going to get into all that today. We're going to talk about some business stuff. We're going to talk about your catalog of games. But what we want to focus in on here is really one of the things that we were talking about when prepping for this interview is that there's a really clear identity to Pandion Games that you see on the website, on your Instagram ads, on your itch page, really intentional, conscious, like focused identity. And I realized as I was looking through these that I'm struggling to put what that identity is into words, but it's like, and I know it when I see it, there is an identity here. So I figured, why not just ask you? So Andy, if you could put the identity of Pandion Games kind of into words for us, how would you put that?
Yeah, so I think it's narrative focused games, but it is specifically away from a focus of combat. And we have that with pretty much everything from the horror games where, you know, you will probably die in one of the horror games, all the way to, you know, the cozy slice of life. Hey, we work at a diner kind of thing. It is more rounded edges of game design, right? It's not prickly. It is much more approachable. I want to use the word cozy, but I don't know if that's 100% accurate. You know, we go for kind of a nostalgia. We look to design games for people that have maybe historically bounced off tabletop role-playing games in the past to kind of be like, hey, we're friendly. You can come, you can approach, you can read this. Everything's good. And, you know, regardless of what genre you're interested in, right? So that's kind of, I don't know if I have a really good way to put it, but I agree. You know, when we talk with other designers, you know, I talk about how it is a Pandion style of game. And it is very intentional how we do that. And I think it stems from when I was first learning game design, I had a mentor, Matt Sanders, and from Sealed Library. And I remember I was writing up this game and everything, and it was an investigative game. And I had a whole chapter on combat and cover and, you know, different pluses to weapons and stuff like that. And he was like, why do you have this? And I was like, well, it's a tabletop game. Like, you need to be able to, you know, if players want to fight, they need to know how to fight. And he was like, they're investigators. Why is this here? You can say that they can fight through your resolution mechanics, but you have 25 pages dedicated to how combat works for, you know, so that really kind of opened my mind of just like, oh, we don't have to do it this way. And so that's always been a big focus going forward. It's just like, we don't have to do it the traditional way that we know of with like wargaming and, you know, maybe even really wonderful games like Morkborg and Mothership. Like, they are focused on combat and fighting and kind of the gruesomer side of going out and, you know, trying to survive. And so Pandion's always been like, what if we kind of take a different approach to that?
It is tough to sometimes get out from underneath the 1,000-pound elephant that is D&D and combat things. You mentioned that you're kind of rounding the corners off edges of games and kind of looking to the players who might have bounced off TTRPGs before. And I think, well, I was looking through your website in advance of this interview, and I was Elliot pointed out your Waffles for Esther.
Yes.
And it has a section in it that I really like on the product page that is just you explaining what solo journaling games is in a really clear, really like, I don't want to say hand-holdy in a pejorative way, but it like a very kind hand-holdy way. And I just want to read it straight because I really like it. Waffles for Esther is a solo journaling game. That means that this game is played by yourself by writing your actions and answers to questions in journal, notebook, or word processor. Write more of your story after each step, dice roll, and card flip. Expand on what happened to have a crazy fun adventure. But don't worry, this book will guide you along the way and show you how to play. I, for a while, before I knew what solo games were, if someone had just told me that, I would have been like, oh, okay, great, I know what it is. But I do really like the idea of being able to guide those players in that might have bounced off it before. I think that's especially true of solo games.
Well, I think part of it's we, like, especially as game designers and people that are in TTRPGs a lot, like if the players that are in TTRPGs a lot, we assume people know what these terms mean or what it is that you're supposed to be doing. And especially with smaller games, like, well, I don't want to dedicate 4 of my 12 pages to explaining how to play. But I think it's still important to put in these little blurbs, right? And like say, hey, here's what this is.
Yeah, it seems like there's a real care given to accessibility for games, like to your customers and your audience, in that, like, one of the other things I was impressed about on your website is this idea that every listing has symbology, like an iconography about how many players it is, what the materials are, and like a short blurb about it. And this carries through from your site to your ads. That, I think, is such a strong touch for getting people to understand what something is right away. Where did this decision to like make this kind of accessibility and education forward come from? Did you learn this like a hard way, or was it just something that like from jump you were like, no, I need to make this clear for everyone?
Some of it was kind of the hard way. Some of it was the mentors I had. So, you know, I very early on in my game design career, I worked with like Matthew Gravelin and Jay Dragon and Matt Sanders, who are very focused on accessibility as well in their own games. And so that helped a lot of just while I was learning how to write games, I was working with people who wrote in an accessible way by default, right? So there was that. But I also come from a background of, so I worked in education for 20 years. I was on the IT side of things, but I did a lot of training and working with teachers to build technology into their curriculum and smart classrooms and stuff like that. And so I got a lot of exposure to how do we take this complex tech piece and explain it in a way, not only so the teachers and the professors could use that tech, but then they could then turn around and explain it to third graders, fifth graders, high schoolers, right? All of that. And so finding those different levels of explanation for what is potentially a complex topic, because there's a lot of complex topics in TTRPGs, is kind of something I've built up over time. And writing that kind of, I don't want to call it documentation, but that's kind of what it is, right? Writing that kind of documentation that says, here's this complex thing. I have boiled it down as simply as I can to explain it. And you'll see this in like my rule summary. So on our larger books, like in Substratum Protocol, at the very beginning, I have one spread. Here's all of the rules simplified. So you can just see everything all at once on one page and just kind of digest that. And then you can dive into kind of the, what are the edge cases? And hey, I have a question about this. And oh, this came up and that's deeper in the book. And that's fine. But I really like this idea of how do we take these 80 pages, 120 pages, and condense it down so we can explain it as clearly as possible across one page. And I want to put that up front. A lot of game designers are like, no, we're going to put that in the back of the book. And I was like, no.
Put all the important stuff right in the beginning.
Yep. Give them the big picture. And they might have questions right after they read that. They're going to be like, oh, well, I don't really understand this. What do you mean by that? Now it's time to go read the book because you have those questions.
It is. It's great to hear some of this stuff because it is funny how you hear it and you're like, of course, that's obvious. Like, of course I should do this. But it is, you don't know what you don't know. And until you finally see the like obvious thing in front of you, you don't know what to do it. And I love finding those little moments.
I will absolutely approach people and I'll say, I don't know enough to ask intelligent questions right now. So I just need you to start throwing things at me, throw data, throw information at me first, because I don't even know how to ask a question right now. And so that's kind of what I try to do with our game design is I want to throw enough bits of information at somebody ahead of time at the very beginning where they go, ooh, now I'm thinking about this. I have this question. I like, how would I do this before they even get into the guts of the book? And I think that's it's the same thing with like the ad images. It's like, okay, here's, you know, that quick one line pitch. Here's your symbols that tell you different things. That's just enough of information where like you go, what do you mean it's a horror letter writing game? That's all I know, but now I know something. And it's not a paragraph of words, right? And now they can start asking questions.
I feel like one of the other ways that like your games pull people in is the visuals of them. Like, you know, you have strong covers, and it's interesting because this is another one of those things I struggled to identify, is that there is a cohesion to the visuals of your library across really different games. And I'm curious, like, when you think about the visual identity of Pandion, like, is there like, do you have a style guide you keep in mind? Is it just you like see a cover and you go, that's not quite a Pandion game? Well, how does that work visually? And as you kind of put this together, because when you see them all together, you're like, oh yeah, these all belong in the same library.
I appreciate that you think I'm organized enough to have a style guide. I do a little bit, but it's mostly based on vibes. But I can tell you, so the main artist that we work with, Galen Peugeot, he's absolutely amazing. He's worked on Stoneburner with Fari. He works with Spencer.
That's right, I know that name.
He's all over the place. The guy is amazing. So what I kind of started as out of necessity, which is working within a limited color palette, working with generally fairly flat colors. So we don't do a lot of shading. It's not like a fully rendered oil painting kind of art. Galen's kind of picked up on and he runs with that. So when we first start doing design and talking about the cover of books, I come to him with here are the five colors that I'm going to be using within the layout. Or I work with him to identify those colors, right? And then those are the only colors he will use in his art at all. He might do some cross-hatching, some dithering, things like that to give some kind of shade work to it, some texture. But overall, I think part of it is this like layered block color approach where we have, you know, we have these different assets and pieces of art and they get layered on top of each other. And that is your cover, that's your art, you know, different things like that. And we've kind of carried that over through everything. And it started off as kind of a necessity because, you know, when we first started off, we had no money. We didn't have an art budget. I didn't know if anything was going to sell. So I didn't know if I could spend money on art. And so, you know, we were working with public domain and maybe creative market for simple stock art. Or I was making something myself with my limited abilities. And then I was working with my partner to be like, I don't know anything about topography. So could you help me out with finding fonts? And fonts became a big deal because if you can't afford art, it at least needs to have really good fonts and layout. And so it's kind of grown from that. And I think you'll continue to see where we use these limited palettes within the cover and within the artwork. Because I agree. I think it's a really nice cohesion that we have. And I'd like to continue it.
There's another element to your work that, like, I think in the years that we've sort of simultaneously been creating has been a growing thing people crave and want, which is solo games. And I think that one of the things that, and this is also an accessibility piece, one of the things that's really interesting about your library is, first of all, you have 7 solo games, just like solo only. You also often make your multiplayer games solo plus, where they have a solo mode. And I was particularly interested in the fact that on the Midnight Muscadines page, in the book section, the first bullet is, there's a solo kit in here. Like, you can play this game right away. Why are you drawn to solo design as a designer? And maybe also, like, on the business side, is there a business consideration to it?
So I want to start back in 2021. This won't be that long of a story, but I don't want anybody to be like, oh no. But so back in 2021, I started working with this wonderful designer. Her name is Armanda Haller, and she was just kind of starting to pioneer this idea of solo journaling games. And I was working with her as well. And this was back during the time where, like, Anna Blackwell with Delph and maybe a 1,000 Year Vampire were really the only solo games. Otherwise, what you had was Geomancy. creators like Mythic and stuff like that. But they didn't really exist on the market. And so we were very much just playing around and seeing what is solo. Can you use cards? Can you play as a solitaire, you know, triangle? There's a Discord server that ended up getting created called Solo But Not Alone. And a bunch of designers jumped in there to do solo design and stuff like that. So we started off very, very early in the design career, really being like, ooh, solo games are cool. And one of the reasons I'm drawn to it, well, there's multiple reasons. One, I love writing. I love telling stories. That's actually the biggest thing that I enjoy about tabletop is storytelling, the narrative. And with a solo game, really what you're doing is you're building a framework and a foundation of a story or of a genre of story that then the player takes and they craft specific stories with that framework. And so I really like this idea of like, ooh, so if I take this and I tweak this here, maybe I seed it with these ideas, what kind of stories can come of that? And I really love that, because although I love writing and I love writing like short stories and stuff like that, I'm really terrible at finishing. And so coming in and being like, oh, I'm going to build this I have a story idea. So Substratum Protocol is perfect. And a lot of our solo games are really good for that, where you say, oh, here's a waitress who has her favorite regular person that comes in and they've gone missing. What happened? Right. That's your framework. So I love developing stuff like that and then putting the rules in place that say, this is the type of story that we're trying to tell. It's a mystery. It's a delving horror game where you're trying to avoid eldritch things that are occurring, or you have to deal with madness that is overtaking you as you delve further down, right? There's rules that are associated with that to like help with that gameplay or help uncover that story for the players. And so that's very much why I absolutely love building out solo games, is because you can kind of build that narrative framework.
Elliot and I, not too long ago, were talking about like, it's wild to us that solo games have picked up so much. Like we wouldn't have expected that 4 or 5 years ago. And even like last year, we wouldn't have expected that. I remember like, what was that game? Ironheart, that raised like $250,000, yeah. Raised an obscene amount of
money.
I'm
not jealous at all. Games. It's fine.
No, yeah, no. Who is?
Right. But what is it? Do you have to be a little prescriptive? Why do you think this has become such a bigger thing in the community?
I think there's two things, maybe more, but definitely two. One was COVID. We all started isolating. We all were sitting maybe with one other person in our house, right? And that one other person might not be the person that likes to play games. And you still have all these interests in things that you wanted to try, and you really wanted to play something, but you couldn't go over to somebody's house responsibly and go play these games. And so, I mean, 2021, 22, 23 was really where we started seeing this boom. And, you know, it's this time where people are more alone, they're more isolated. Maybe it's harder to schedule because now we're in disparate. People moved across the country because of COVID. And so the original friend group is, maybe it's online only. And while online is great, that's still scheduling. And it's still not the same as sitting around a table with your friends with pizza and Cheetos and Mountain Dew and maybe some beers and wine and you're just having a hollering good night. Online's still a bit different. And so I feel like people gravitated more towards solo games because you can still have kind of these experiences and these really exciting moments of rolling dice, narrative gameplay, and you can do it whenever you want. You can do it at any time that you want. You don't have to schedule it with anybody else. It's not once a month or once every other week and somebody cancels. And so maybe you have to cancel the whole game. You go, hey, I really want to explore this world or I want to do this thing. And you just sit down and you do it. And I think that's fantastic that we're providing that. Notice it with board games too. We're starting to see it a lot more at board games where they go, it's 1 to 6 players and we have specific rules for the solo mode. Like, and maybe we've changed the game completely how the game plays for solo mode. And we kind of see that starting with in tabletops. Like when people first started doing solo support within tabletop role-playing games, it was here's the multiplayer version of the game. And then we have this whole separate rule set for if you want to play it solo or tweaks. Like, here's three pages of tweaks to make it work solo. And now, 4 or 5 years later, what we're starting to see is people build the ability to play solo into the game by default. And it just so happens to also support playing GM play as well, which is kind of your default. And that's kind of what we're doing with like Substratum Protocol and Midnight Muscadine specifically is an even larger version of that, where it's the rule set does not change. The rules, there is no like list of like, here's the rules that you need to change in order to play solo. That does not exist for Midnight Muscadines. What exists is, here's how you create story. Here's rules that replace the GM. Here's tables. Here's this and that. But the rules themselves are the same, regardless if you're playing as a group or you're playing solo. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that too, which I think is just super exciting.
I was really excited to see that on your Kickstarter page, that that Midnight Muscadine supports solo, duet, GM-less, as well as GM play. I don't fully know what that looks like, and I'm excited to learn more and find out.
It's one where, so what we discovered was, if you build the rules to support somebody going at it solo, so all the rules were kind of player facing rather than GM facing, and the GM, their purpose now becomes more of a facilitator of the story, not of the rules, not of the roles, of the story. That really opens you up, so that role can live with anybody. Right? They're just facilitating the narration, or, oh yeah, I'm going to look, instead of you looking at this random table, I'm going to look at the random table and tell you what happens. That role can now live with anybody because they're not rolling dice behind a screen to see who hits or how much damage, or, you know, they don't have to have that task anymore. And so once you kind of make that be able to live with anybody that's at the table, even if it's just one person, it really opens up with, like, you know, for instance, on a duet game, we experimented with this with Badger and Coyote. You have a token, and the person whose job it is to kind of have the GM's responsibilities pass back and forth between the scenes. So one scene, one player is going, okay, so this is what happens, blah, 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 and then you're both rolling to see what happens, and you narrate both players' characters' events. And then on the next scene, you pass that token to the other person, and now it's their turn to, you know, really build the scene. And so each person has this opportunity to be surprised still, because one scene they're giving the surprise and the next scene they're getting the surprise. And so we kind of build that into games going forward. I'm actually really excited about it.
It's cool. It's a really interesting design space that I think will be more popular, probably, like you're saying, and I think makes sense, you know, that like if you design it a certain way, that all works. Real quick, before I do want to get into Midnight Muscadines a little bit more, but you mentioned Badger and Coyote, and I think that Badger and Coyote is this game that is indicative of your journey as a business, where like you have invested in small consumable games, like small, like easy to access consumable games, and the price points on your website are not high, which I think is like another element of accessibility. You can get like the horror bundle, which is 8 games, I believe, or 7 games in a journal.
I think it's 8. Yeah, and it also comes with a journal.
And that's only $118. Like, so I think from a business perspective, I'm curious about how you've built the business on, obviously, Midnight Muscadines and Substratum Protocol started to get larger, and Midnight Muscadines is obviously large, but how have you built a sustainable business where you were able to go full-time, you were telling us, in January, which congratulations again. How did you kind of build that on these small sort of, I don't want to say bite-sized because they're bigger than a bite, but they're not quite, you know.
I agree. We started with basically 12-pagers, so little 12-page zines. And I think it's important, if you're going to do small games, you need to have a decent number of them. Like, if I only had Waffles for Esther on my catalog, I could not go full-time on that one game. And so with this bite-sized game, you need to have multiples that people can pick up. Think like going, like when you're checking out a store and there's like that whole candy section and they're all kind of cheap, right? And you're like, ooh, I'm feeling a little hungry. And so you'll be like, I'm going to pick up a Reese's, maybe some Milk Duds, and maybe write like that pick up and go kind of mentality. And so these smaller zines priced between like $10 to $15 kind of does that for people. And so instead of coming to a site and being like, I can buy one $40 book, some people come and say, I can only buy one $10 game. And that's fantastic. That's totally fine. But a lot of people come to the store and they say, I can buy three of these games. And now I have a horror game and I have a, you know, cozy slice of life game. And I have a group game about, you know, a horror summer camp with camp counselors, right? And that's, you know, that differentiation is really cool. But to get going was interesting. So what we would do, so I published my first four games while I was unemployed and living out of an RV. And so I had no money. And what we did was we pitched the games to different online retailers like Exalted Funeral and Knave of Cups and just, you know, a bunch of online retailers. And they'd be like, yes, I want 10 or I want 25 or, you know, whatever the number was of each game. And we would take all of that money and we would buy as many books as we could, fulfill to the retailers, and then the rest would go to either IPR or stay with me to sell on my site or and then provide restocks. And that's kind of how we got going for absolutely zero money. We weren't doing crowdfunding. We weren't, right? I was basically just taking in retailer orders, making pitches, which Matthew Gravelin was the one that was teaching me that. We were talking about Matthew Gravelin earlier. He was the one that was like, hey, here's how you write a pitch. Here's how I got in with IPR and some of these other places. Here's how you do this. And pricing in such a way where we always talk about how the margins on tabletop role-playing games and board games and stuff like that are very, very thin. When you first get going, you don't have a lot of choice because you're going to probably be printing with Mixum. You can probably only print 100 to maybe 300 books. So that's kind of a fixed cost, but finding a printer where you can get down to like either under a dollar or up to like $1.50 per book, that's super important because, you know, we're talking about like you want to hit the 8x and the 10x of for pricing and stuff like that. And obviously, it's a very short ceiling for these small games. $10, maybe $12 if you go from 12 to, you know, 16 pages or 20 pages, right? It's a very small amount. So you got to get your margin super low. And then at that point, you really have to focus on selling a lot. And that's where, you know, you start talking about hollering on Blue Sky or maybe talk about advertising and different stuff like that. But it is, don't pay for any of the print runs. Have those paid ahead of time. Order as many books as you can to get the lowest price on there so you have the highest margin. And then try to sell as to many customers as possible rather than retail because, again, highest margin. And then you reinvest that, right? And I was super lucky because after we did those first print runs and stuff like that, I was able to get another job and go, okay, I'm going to take all the money from Pandion, because it's still not a lot, and reinvest that. Now we're going to buy art. Maybe we'll do a larger print run so the books are even cheaper. I'll reach out to more people. Maybe I spend $5 a day on an Instagram ad. You know, things like that to kind of reinvest into the business for these small books. And then you just kind of grow, right? You're like, okay, so I've got five books now. I'm going to design something else. It's another 12-pager. Now we have more. Now let's put together a bundle. Now I have enough horror games. I can bundle it into a horror bundle. People love bundles. And now instead of paying 10, you know, each purchase being $10 for the purchase, now they're paying $50 or $60 or $70, but it still only cost me maybe $5 to $8 for all of these little books, right? Whereas if you get into a big book, right? If you're talking big A4 hardback with 250, you've got to order, you either have to order 5,000 books, which is untenable for business our size, or you're paying $13 to $20 a book. That's scary.
yeah.
And so that's where it's like, okay, well, if we just bundle a bunch of small books, we can, it's still only $5-$8. And then, you know, we're now making $50 a sale instead of $10 a sale. So $40 in profit rather than, you know, $8 in profit. So that's kind of how we built up over time. And then, yeah, of course, then we start getting into slightly larger books as well. It's the talk of-
Hey, campers, have you heard of Season 5 of Five Gems in a Trench Coat from Inside the Tent? You haven't? Well, let us tell you about it.
A nice, green, natural regional park. This is Hidden Falls Regional Park. For our purposes in our world, it's a bit larger than it actually is. It is the summer of 1983, and it is all of your first time getting to stay at Hidden Falls.
We promise it's going to be a great time. It's going to be a story of three childhood friends going across the Americas in 1987 using Kids on Bikes 2nd edition. So grab a blanket, make some coffee. The first three episodes are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
As far as finding customers, and you mentioned like advertising, you know, using Instagram ads or stuff, at that early stage, because I'm sure there are people listening who are like, I've got three or four small games and it's tough to find people who are interested. What did you find was most and least effective to like find customers for these types of games?
Ooh, yeah, it's really hard. It's really, really hard when you're getting going. So obviously word of mouth is very important. So we were doing Twitter and, you know, posting on all the socials and Instagram and all that stuff. Building a mailing list was huge. So we have spent years building our mailing list. And that can be multiple mailing lists. So for instance, like when you put something up on itch.io and somebody buys it on itch.io, they go on a mailing list for that product. Use that. That's huge. So things like that. But then also, and these are all free things, right? Mailing list should be free. Don't spend money on a mailing list. That's silly. Some people do that. Don't do that at your early stage. But also, think about not TTRPG scenes and how your game might be received by somebody outside of that. So for instance, Badger and Coyote, huge hit with anybody in the sciences, in the natural sciences, huge hit at outdoor stores. So we get purchases from outdoor retailers that want to carry our books as like a counter, like on their counter at the checkout, sure. Right? And we're talking, you know. And so we get purchases from people like that. People have also like in stationery stores and like candle shops have purchased our games. And so we've reached out to these people specifically and been like, okay, so maybe not just TTRPG players, but like people who have these other interests where this game kind of fits those vibes. With some of our horror games, they have a lot of camping things. So we talked with people who did like Boy Scouts and after school activities and, you know, camping events and different stuff like that in order to kind of hopefully reach out to people outside of our sphere. We keep talking about how, oh, we just all pass the same $5 back and forth. And to a large extent, that's true. And really, your core audience is going to remain the TTRPG scene. So I'm not saying ignore that. Should absolutely build up a community and find cool people and do cool things within the TTRPG community. But to like break beyond that, to really get your sales going, really start looking at, like, we follow, like, so for instance, on Instagram, we started following these stationery stores and we started, so they would be like, oh, hey, Pandian Games follow you. And they're like, who's Pandian Games? And they would look at our profile and they'd be like, oh, hey, this is actually kind of cool. And so like, that was one of the methods that we used to try to get out there. And like, for instance, so Storyteller had a cool mechanic where you could tell a story to an audience and it was an interactive audience rather than active players. There's whole mechanics behind it. And I really need to promote that better, but it's due up for like a redesign. So I'm not talking about Storyteller too much. But what we learned was that like, hey, people in theater would love this because you could have one or two people up on stage interacting with an audience, right? Or telling a story. Or we found out people were just using the prompts in the book to create the beginning of the story and then using another system to play that story. And I'm like, that's fine. Like, that's great too. And solo games are fantastic for that, where people are like, oh, I picked this up in order to do this, like build something with these prompts. And then I'm going to go over here and use that to do something else. Fantastic. Do that. So yeah, especially if you don't have like we did not have money to do any advertising until the last like 12 to 18 months. And then we started off very, very small, like $2 a day. We would post an Instagram ad and we'd boost it for $2 a day for 10 days and be like, did we make any sales? I don't know. And like try to really figure that out. And, you know, it obviously everybody's at a different stage, but it's an easy way to dip your toe into like not just yelling on social media, because that can be exhausting, and kind of being like, okay, I got $20. I'm going to set $20 aside. I'm going to run this ad for 10 days and just see what happens, drive people to my store. Maybe I can make some purchases and just kind of test it. Whereas I think a lot of people think that going into advertising, you got to have like $500 or $1,000, or it's so risky because, you know, you could just lose a bunch of money. And I agree, there are definitely platforms out there where that can absolutely happen if you're not careful. But boost an ad, boost a post on Instagram, spend $2. You got to let it run for a little bit so it can figure out what it's doing. But find things like that where if you make one or two sales, you've broken even, right? That was kind of my goal at first while we were learning all this, was if I spend some money and I make exactly that money back, that's good. That means I can do it again and maybe do it better. And so that's kind of how we started with advertising. And you know, I think there's a lot of people that can tell you how to market towards the TTRPG scene. And like community building's huge. And I'm terrible at it. We're actually in talks right now with a community support person just to be like, I don't know what to do. I'm really bad at engaging my players and I love my players but I'm just really bad at asking questions and putting together events, and I'm not good at that. And so, you know, if you are good at that, lean into it, build your community, build events, run itch.io game jams, run, you know, different things where people can come and check out your stuff and be like, oh yeah, this is cool. I want to make something for it. And that is huge, because that's how you get really dedicated people that want to do stuff for your games.
Ooh, a lot of good stuff in there. There's like I'm trying to figure out what the best stuff to pull out, because it is like, I think one of the things you said in there that I really resonated with as a small business owner is like, okay, I'm going to spend this money, and if I can make it back, that's good. You know, like that is such a key kind of like mentality thing that I think is important in early days. Like I remember I did my first ever like local con tabling, and it was like at an art festival, and I didn't sell a lot of games, but I just broke even on the festival. So I was like, okay, I know I can set up a table and I can sell games, and then like hopefully the next con will be like profitable, but this one was break even. So now I know I can do this thing, I can sell. It's like there's so many things about like doing this and getting it to a business where you just have to make yourself believe the sentence, I can do that because I just did, and then move to the next one.
You really want to get those first reps in like a low risk environment.
Oh, absolutely.
Like just get to the plate and swing, knowing that it doesn't matter if you connect.
It is an incredibly, every task that you do building your business is incredibly hard and terrifying the first time you do it. And then by the fifth time you do it, you're just like, oh, this is just a Tuesday. It's fine. We're just going to take care of this.
Yeah.
Right. But that first step is terrifying because you've never done it before. But you do have to go into it with the mentality of just like, I'm not the first one to do this. I know it's possible. I know I can do it. I can do it. Now I'm going to go like have a breakdown in the corner beforehand, but I can do it.
Elliot, I know we talked about this with you with like when you ran your first crowdfunding campaign or like your first big one for Product Deco, it was like scary and nervous and it was of many emotions. And then not too long ago when you were running the crowdfunding campaign for Vidya Tivaledi's game, A Land Once Magic, the way you talked about it was very much like, oh yeah, I can do, like that's super easy. I can do that on the side while I'm doing other stuff.
Yeah,
and it was No, that one was actually more complicated than the initial one. And you are now at a point of treating it like, yeah, that's, I don't want to say it's on autopilot because you put in a lot of hard work to it, but like,
yeah, sure.
You knew the path to it. You were like, I know how to do that now. That's not a big deal. It'll be work, but it's all work I know how to do.
Yeah. It's the perspective shift is good, and it's also good to have people like you, Brian, around who make you stop for a second and go, wait a minute, this used to give you nearly a panic attack to do, and now you're doing it for someone else amidst a bunch of other work. So yeah, it is funny the way that your brain changes in making a business work. It's crazy.
Oh, it does. And what I think's hilarious is we get to the point. So like I still remember to this day the first $2 tip I got on the very first thing I ever posted. I remember that because it was where I was like, somebody will pay for this? Yes, let's go, right? Like, and, you know, years later, you know, I have to remind myself that I was very excited about that $2 when I'm like, that's been kind of a slow month. And like, I'm looking at my numbers and I'm like, no, pause. We are doing so much better than we were last year. Like, this is crazy. Like, these are numbers beyond what I could even have imagined when I first started. Like you get used to it, but then you also need to remind yourself of how far you've come.
Yeah.
You got to remember that $2 tip, even when it doesn't mean anything to the grand scheme of things anymore, is still exciting.
Yeah. Oh, it's very exciting. I still, when I get a $2 tip on itch.io for like a game, I'm like, oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
When someone pays for a pay what you want game, I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful.
I've got a question. I want to ask one more question about like advertising and like getting those early swings in early that is maybe a little bit self-serving because currently, as of time recording, we're running some ads for Midnight Muscadines and for your current crowdfunding campaign.
Yes.
I'm curious for you as a business owner and a game designer and someone who is looking at a lot of opportunities out there, how do you look at the various opportunities and say, this one I think is worth investing in, this one I don't think is worth investing in? This is going to be very self-serving. And if you don't want to answer this on mic, we can cut it out. But like, why did you look at us as a test case and be like, this one's worth investing in? And like, how can new business owners, new designers be looking at opportunities out there and like picking the right calls?
Yeah. So there are multiple reasons to advertise. Everybody thinks about the making of sales, right? That's, which makes sense, right? Like you want to make money on your ads. That's fine. Yeah, I totally understand that. But there's also raising awareness, right? And one of the things that we struggle with today is we're making sales, but nobody's talking about our games. So there's not awareness, right? From a larger community perspective, I struggle with the awareness of our games. And so when I was looking at different ways to advertise, Meta and Instagram ads and stuff like that, those are the conversions. That's like, we're spending the kind of money where I need people to come to the page and purchase something. And then things like the mid-ad roll that you guys put together for us and like going on podcasts and things like that, you have a very specific audience of TTRPG players that love multitudes of different stuff. And while I hope that converts over to sales, really what it is for me working with you guys is getting the name of Pandion, getting Muscadines, getting this idea of something, you know, this difference game in front of these really kind of dedicated players, people who are really deep in the scene, and making them aware that we exist and making them aware that Midnight Muscadines exists. So it is, for me, there's that two tiers. And when you first start, you don't worry about these splits. You don't have the money for it. I barely have the money for it. But like, there's the, I want conversions, I want purchases. There's a specific kind of ad that you need to look at and figure out what to do for those things. And then there's the long-term, like, I don't know if we want to get into this, but the marketing funnel, right? There, you know, and you start with awareness and you go to like people talking about the game, and then you have conversions and you have your really core group at the bottom. That's like your word of mouth people that evangelize your business. That's kind of the funnel. And so working with like a podcast, like Many Sided Media, is very much awareness and building fans and making, you know, people aware that might, you know, not only purchase the game, so like, that's cool, but also be like, I want to make something for this, or this was a cool idea and now I want to make something and I'm going to say that it was inspired by Midnight Muscadines, or, you know, different things like that. That whole community aspect that I was talking about is kind of, well, one, you'd reached out and I had already heard a lot about Many-Sided Media and people are like, you need to go talk to Many-Sided Media and Brian. And I'm like, I know, but I'm really nervous about it. And then you reached out and I was like, yeah, okay, let's go. I'll spend some money here. And I know that your entire media company and podcast is well respected. All of your podcasts are well respected. And like, that's where I want to be. More than anything else, if I'm doing especially bespoke ads, like because you guys recorded an absolutely wonderful mid-roll ad for me, I want to make sure that they're being presented on platforms that are well-respected. And that can be small. Like that, well-respected does not mean they're large. It means, you know, they're respectable people and nice people. That's very important to me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if that answers your question directly, but like,
no, it does.
It was very much an awareness piece where I wanted to get out in front of your listeners and say, hey, this is Pandion. This is Midnight Muscadines. It's cool. It's fine if you don't buy. I'm not, you know, this is less about purchasing. I think it would be great. But like, it is more about, I want your listeners to know that we exist. Right.
Mm. So in the interest of time, I do want to shift over now to Midnight Muscadines a bit and ask about both, like, I want to get into what this game is because I think it's got a really fun, interesting premise, but it is also the largest project that you're tackling as a business.
By far.
So what made you ready to tackle a project of this size, and what is Midnight Muscadines?
So Midnight Muscadines is about deliciously magical jam. That you go out and craft. So the core piece is that you are marmoteers and you are striking out into the twilight of the Wildernight, where the last source of magic still grows and is concentrated within the grapes of the Midnight Muscadine plant. And so you go out and you harvest these grapes, and that is what still allows the world magic to exist. And so you preserve them down, and you store this magical jam in the Marmoteer cellars beneath Lake Solon, and that gets distributed over the course of the year to all of the places that still need magic to function. And you go out and harvest, you know, whenever Midnight Muscadines is. So that's the basic premise of the game. And like we had talked before, it is very solo-centric, but it's designed for play of any kind of group type, which is really cool. And your second question was?
So I think that it's important to highlight, like, the book here is going to be 150 plus pages, I think.
Yeah, I think we're sitting at like 180.
180. What, from your 12-page zines to Substratum, I think was in the
88
to now 180. What made you ready to tackle a project of this size?
Well, so I think it is like steps. So everything I do is stepping up as we go. So 12-page zines, 24-page zines, 44-page, right? Like the whole thing. And I think I was finally at a point where there was a game that I've wanted to make for a long, long time. And, you know, that has a full setting and can be played as a campaign. Most of our games are solo-based and they kind of have a beginning, middle, and end. And so you might play them for 3 to 5 sessions. But I really love campaigns from a gameplay perspective. And so I really wanted to make this kind of bigger game that was still a Pandion game that could be played more of a campaign, more sandbox, more open. And so, I wanted to be rules easy, not necessarily rules light, but give players a lot of ability to say, okay, here's my player. I can get into it quickly. I don't need to know a bunch of fiddly rules to really get going. But if you're like, ooh, I really want to do this really cool thing, or hey, I'm looking at it, these abilities, and if I have this ability and this ability, I could chain that together and I could do something really cool. Or, you know, I really, you know, dials for players to tweak. Because I think that's something that players really like to do. That's the game part of a role-playing game. So I wanted to really explore that more. It's something that I enjoy doing during my own play. And then also the setting. I had been working kind of on a setting document before Midnight Muscadines was even a concept. That's where the idea of the Wilder Knight and Nim and the Shattered Sun and these different, you know, the two gods and the great spirits. And that's where all that came from, was I had been working on this setting in the background for a while. And I was like, yeah, this is the game for that, right? Because it's the jam mixed with some of the history. Like, you got autumnal nostalgia, the coziness of a lot of these aspects. But then you also have, one, literal darkness. And then also, you know, dark themes kind of interwoven throughout that are transpiring. And so I kind of wanted this to be a flagship game, honestly, something that people could poke at and interact with and discover things and add their own canon to. And a small game just full of tables wasn't going to be able to satisfy that, in my opinion.
It's fun to take this back to the beginning of this conversation. There, you call this a cozy dark game, and I when I read that in preparation for this interview, I was like, that could almost define Pandion games.
with the
breadth of games you have. Like, you've got cozy, you've got horror, you talked about like rounding the edges. It does feel like, I like that you're thinking about it as a flagship, because it does feel like it feels like a flagship of like the stuff you've been working towards, which is really cool.
Yeah. And we do have, like, I have so many plans for this game beyond the core book. And I'm always hesitant to talk about it because I was like, the campaign's going on right now. And yeah, I need to get the book out. But I mean, I want to do so many
cool
things.
Well,
the
campaign's going well right now. So talk about some of your cool plans.
So, like, I'm curious. Some of the cozy aspects of it, I would love to, I've actually talked with Steph from Fistful of Crits, because she does the Toe Beans expansion for 5e. And I was like, I would love like mechanics and aspects and a little expansion where the entire game is you are the owner of a cafe or you're the owner of a tea house. And it's people coming in with drama, people coming in with different things you need to do, almost kind of like a Strange Horticulture game, like the video game Strange Horticulture, where it's like, here's all of your ingredients, we're doing crafting, we still have your stats and everything, but now we also added in like shop mechanics to be a shop owner. I would love to have that, because the world supports that so well, to be able to be like, okay, well, what town are you in with your shop, and do you need to go to another town, and we've got guilds that maybe are running illicit goods to you, you know ingredients from out in the Wilder Knight that you're going to need in order to craft this thing for this person, and so now you got to go work with the field hands. So like, there's a bunch of really cool stuff that we could do there. I would love to write a campaign book for kind of the larger world aspect of things. So the main game is going to be really about going out and finding Midnight Muscadines and kind of the adventures around that, and participating in, you know, Nim itself and how that magic infuses into the world of Nim. But we have these concepts like the tapestry below the earth, and it is an interconnected, it's where the interconnections of these three other worlds happen, Dusk, Song, and Dream. And, you know, so there's this, and your ancestors, the whole reason we have a Shattered Sun is because they trapped the sun god after killing the night god. And he was so enraged, he shattered the sun. And now he's in a prison somewhere, but it's forgotten. I would love to have a campaign that explores that, right? Of the sun god getting back out and being like, those final sun shards that are lighting them, they got to go. And rampaging, right? I would love to have a campaign book about that. So like, it's really interesting. Oh, and then also the Wilder Knight itself. So one thing that we do with all of our books is they're kind of also in-game artifacts. So for instance, in Substratum Protocol, it was written from the point of view of the Fracture Observatory, and there's an unknown scientist writing notes in the sides of every page and all of this stuff. And with Midnight Muscadines, it's written from the point of view of people in Nim, so the Marmoteers and the university there and stuff like that. And so everything out in the Wilder Knight is kind of hearsay. And I even put that, like, we, at the very beginning, I kind of put the book where I was like, this could be, you know, a false narrator kind of situation going on. Not much is known about the Wilder Knight. And so in the future, I would love to release an expansion where it's written from the point of view of people in the Wilder Knight instead. And I think that would be really cool.
It's really fun that you're coming at the idea of the future of this game and potential expansions from, let's be very clear, we're starting with a game about finding and preserving jam.
Yeah.
And then it's gonna go from a hyper niche idea and then just expand out on the world, because you've built a very rich world in that. And it's like, rather than just look at one little pinpoint of it, let's start to look at the broader scopes or the different people that interact with this magical jam.
Well, and so the nice thing is the whole jam aspect is our magic system, right? So you craft, that's your crafting spells, and people can get additional jam jars to carry two spells at once. And because it's jam, your spells can skunk based upon the number of usages and like go bad.
That's so good.
And so like you're always collecting ingredients from around the world and adding them to your jam jar to get new magical effects. And then those go bad because you use them so much. And so now you got to add new ingredients in. And so there's this really cool pinpoint of like, you know, it almost seems silly, right? Like, oh, you're making jam. But it's this really, what I think is a really interesting basis for this like really narrative magic system that I don't think we've really seen yet. Yeah, I'm really excited for it. So like even with these, you know, expansions, it still goes back to this concept of this like narrative magic.
It's really, it's itching the same part of my brain as the game we just made with Viditya of A Land Once Magic, of like, this feels like a world of that game of like, it's fantasy, but it's not fantasy like you've ever thought about it or seen it before. Like it's jam magic, and it's got this. Yeah, I really love the world building you've done here. That's really, really cool. And I'm excited to see these other books. And at time of recording, over 30K on the backer kit. Hopefully that means that you've got some like funds to invest in that future of the game, which we love to see. We love
to see people. No, we'll definitely, in the future of the all of those things will happen. Because I will make them happen. I want to see and play those things. So yeah, no, it'll definitely happen.
Andy, if you'll indulge me as we kind of come to a close, as somebody who went full time last January, you just went full time this January. I feel like I'm curious because I get asked this question a lot. What does your week look like as a full time game designer and small business owner?
It is okay. Yeah. So my weeks are usually, so I start with like packing orders. I am, you know, kind of looking at analytics, making sure things are still on track, and then diving into socials and, you know, checking in on Discord and Blue Sky. And then because we're in the middle of game development, there's just a lot of game development happening right now with doing edits, and I'm working with M. Allen Hall as a writer. So he's, you know, working with him for, you know, answering questions and figuring stuff out like that. And then also like a lot of inventorying and making sure I don't need to submit new print runs and stuff like that. So there's a lot of that happening. And then I also go on dog walks whenever I want, which is really nice.
That is, love and that's the dream.
Yes, exactly.
Hell yeah.
And then Andy, the last question that we like to ask on this show is the same question we ask every person who comes on the show is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking you for a recommendation of anything that you'd like to recommend to our audience. So it could be a movie, a book, it could be going on walks with your dog, it could be inside of tabletop, it could be outside of tabletop. What are you bringing to the table?
Oh man, I would love to just say, if you're really interested in like the cozy dark aspect, people kept recommending it to me, and I finally watched it like 2 weeks ago. But Frieren, the anime, is absolutely in the same vibes as Midnight Muscadines, in my opinion. It is just such a cozy but incredibly dark show. Highly, highly recommend it if you want to get into this interesting, like kind of more modern, very laid back, cozy vibe. That's also like, oh, this is kind of dark. That I think that show is amazing. Oh, I also got recently picked up a really cool board game. If we want to talk about really cool solo play, right? We were talking about solo and like bringing stuff in. So it was called Deep Regrets. They just shipped their Kickstarter. That's how I got mine. I love that game, especially to play it solo. It's basically like Gotta Catch 'Em All Pokemon, but for Eldritch deep sea fishing, and it's wonderful.
Dope. Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the art, and that's...
The art's real good.
Man, that's so sick.
Andy, thank you so much for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you, and also
where they can find Pandion Games.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me at Pandion Games on Blue Sky, Discord, pretty much all socials that we are Pandion Games. And then you can also find us at pandiongames.com. That is where we pretty much sell all of our physical and digital books. And then also pandiongames.itch.io for everybody that loves itch.io.
And if you want more gaming content from us, please join the Many-Sided newsletter or the Many-Sided Media Discord, where you can chat about this and all of our Talk of the Table episodes. You can also support Talk of the Table on Patreon at the Many-Sided Media Patreon, where you'll get ad-free episodes, bonus roundtables, as well as a bunch of great stuff for our other show, My First Dungeon, and Talk of the Table. Please rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.